Hey, this is Macy Gray, and you are listening to OC Caravan with Scott Hayes and Jim Bass. Come on.
Okay, you're listening to KEX 93.5, Laguna's only FM. I'm Scott Hayes, and this, of course, is OC Caravan. And that's our new, what do you call that, a sounder or a sweeper or whatever it is?
I don't know. We never learned that terminology.
Yeah, we never did, but that was Macy Gray, by the way, giving us a shout-out. Jim?
Yes. I leave for 1 week, and you get a sort of A-list guest, and holy cow. Wow.
Multi-platinum.
Love
Grammy Award-winning.
Yeah. I got to leave more often, apparently.
Hey, just a reminder, OC Caravan airs 8 p.m. Saturdays, 12 noon Sundays on Cox Channel 3, 250,000 Cox subscribers. This weekend is John Vallely, the UCLA basketball standout, friend of yours, right, Jim?
Yep, UCLA legend.
UCLA legend, played in the NBA as well, and has a compelling story to share with our viewers on that.
Yeah, his personal battle with cancer. He lost his daughter. He's been a huge advocate and supporter of the Pediatric Cancer Research Foundation. Great show. Great guy. Great stories.
Yeah, and they misspelled his name on the Cox thing there.
So nice.
Yeah, I thought I'd point that out. So,
if we're anything, we're honest, right?
Yeah, we got a great show this morning. We got to move quickly. Let's start with Miss Jill Harvey and the Healthy Lifestyle, our Healthy Lifestyle reporter, Miss Jill.
Good morning.
What's going on?
Hey, so we have some good news and bad news first. Good news is, if you were one of those who started your New Year's resolutions, you're done.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, the four-week thing is over. You're good for the year. Don't worry about it until next year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, the bad news is, I'm kidding. Get your big boy pants on, big girl pants on, and get to it.
All right.
Yeah. No, truly, in the gym, we're seeing everybody, the classes, the gym environment, there's less population there now.
Is that right? Already?
They were surging in, and it's thinning out now. So, yeah. But we're really getting to, Scott, you had asked me a few weeks ago what the difference was between rolled quick cooking oats and steel cut oats.
Yeah.
What a perfect opportunity.
Good call.
So it's all about the processing. So the viewers can't see this, but I'm holding up, and I don't know if anybody can see in here. In my right hand, I have the quick cooking rolled oats, and here are steel cut oats. And it's all about how they're processed. So the quick cooking rolled oats, they are cut. They are thinned out, they are rolled, they are steamed, and they are rolled again. So their surface area is very big. In these little steel cut, they're just cut thicker. They're both whole grain, so they're good for you, but the steel cut will digest slower because the surface area on the quick cooking oats is wider. So the digestive enzyme will get to the starch inside there quicker and break it down in your system quicker. On the steel cut, it takes a longer time for the enzyme to get to the starch.
Huh.
So it's a slow breakdown in your system. This is important. Why?
No idea.
All right. Good answer. So it's important because of the glycemic index.
Oh.
So the quicker digesting one is going to spike your blood sugar.
You do that.
The slower one is going to digest slower, and it won't spike your insulin levels. And that's important. Why?
We're all shaking our heads.
No idea.
All right. I'm glad I'm here this morning. So because of type 2 diabetes, the higher your blood sugar, the more prone you are pushing yourself toward that condition, toward inflammation. But the good news is both of them do contain fiber, and they do contain B vitamins. So you're better off having in a quick instant the rolled quick cooking than Captain Crunch. But I have a suggestion on the steel cut. You can cook them in your slow cooker overnight. If you're in a hurry in the morning, overnight, little bit of almond milk, coconut milk, whatever your desire is.
Mm-hmm.
You can throw in some raisins, some nuts, and you're good to go.
Nice.
So yeah.
Can you put those in the microwave?
I tend not to microwave things.
So but you could if someone was really
good. Why don't you use the microwave?
You know, it's just that it's the heat, the rapid process of heating and cooking, they're still not confirmed whether that's good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I stay away from that.
All right.
Yeah.
So here I thought steel cut was purely a marketing pitch.
There you go.
And actually, it has real benefit.
It has real benefit. They're also known as groats or Irish oats. So that is it, my friends.
Wow. Well, very nice, Miss Jill. Very nice. We appreciate
Captain Crunch. Yay.
But I love crunch berries.
We're scrambling here this morning. So we also have in the studio this morning our resident food stalker, Miss Sandy Ward, who's got a guest that she's going to introduce, and looks like some appetizing food. So, Sandy, take it away.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us and being the food stalker in the house. I thought that it would be important for us to include a very Or am I standing in the right place
there.
Okay. I thought it'd be important for us to bring in a local chef here. I'm sure if for those of you who maybe have been sleeping under a rock, everyone has heard of The Deck and Driftwood Kitchen. And I'm pleased we have our guest here this morning is Reinar Schwartz, chef for the restaurant. I thought we might start out. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. We know he has food, so we're excited, right? And I thought we'd start out with just a little bit of background, understand that you are from Austria. And can you share with us maybe with your grandma and some early inspirations and what that was like growing up there?
I grew up in a small town called Klagenfurt, 100,000 people, right in the mountains, you can imagine. Only restaurants there. Bars, wineries, you name it. So naturally, I grew up in the restaurant business, hotel business. We had our own winery, still have it. Brew our own beer, had a whole bunch of restaurants, run hotels. So it came natural to me. You know, when I was really young, I started cooking and just got passionate about it and never got away from it, you know.
And I understand you have such an incredible resume. 4-year apprentice at an old Austrian castle. You traveled to Switzerland. You were in Germany, France, working in 5-star restaurants. And why did you leave then to go to other?
Well, I opened up a cruise line called Crystal Cruises in the 90s, and my wife is from New York, and
East
obviously,
Coast girl.
Yeah, exactly, and obviously Austria is too small for a New York girl, so she couldn't. It didn't work, you know. So we had to move to the U.S. Was not planning on it, but I think now finally I found a home here in Laguna and. Was traveling for quite some time, but this is it, you know, no more traveling. I will stay here now.
This is your home.
This is my home.
Your home. And tell us now, what was the inspiration for the restaurant? You've traveled all over the world. Mm-hmm. And why Laguna Beach? And what's the inspiration behind the name?
Well, you know, my partners and I are just a couple of simple guys. You know, we just want to do good, honest food and have some great customer service and want to do what we really enjoy doing, and we found the right spot. You know, you can't get any closer to the ocean, can't get any closer to the beach. You know, went through some really a long period of time of remodeling to get this thing right, and you know, after a year and a half into it, you know, we finally opened it. Now we got it exactly the way how we want it, and we are very proud of it. And
yeah, the property has good bones. I don't know, have all of you stopped by and been there?
No, it's one of my favorite spots.
Isn't it great? Yeah. Right on the water with the waves
crashing. Doesn't get better than that.
As a matter of fact, my family and I, we spent Christmas Eve there with my son, Ryan Ward, who works at the restaurant. And I think one of my favorite dishes, oh, goodness, I mean, you know, the seafood, the salmon, you do really well. You're a fish guy, so
sure.
What are some of your favorite dishes there?
Just simple food, you know, that's what it really comes down to. You know, they have some really great vendors. We try to go, of course, with local vendors. You know, our seafood is the freshest one you basically can buy, you know, less than 24 or 48 hours out of the water. And we just prepare it very simple, you know, very honest, straightforward food, and that's what works for us. And, you know, it's going well.
And how do you support farm to table? I know that's a phrase that's tossed around quite a bit, but how would you say you support, quote,
well,
farm
it's not
to
like,
table?
There's nothing new, you know, everybody does it. You know, it's like 1,000 years, you know, everybody went for the farm and put it on the table, you know, now it's like this new term and everybody goes crazy over it, but it's basically every great chef knows exactly what to do and, you know, everybody, it works for everybody, you know, so there's no big secret to it, you know, you just find really good ingredients, work with the local farmers and, you know, prepare it and put it on the table, you know, as simple as it is.
Sandy, I have a favorite on their menu. The Breakfast of Champions is my favorite meal that you serve.
All right.
Explain to the listeners,
it's a cocktail, actually. Yeah, it actually
is. Bloody Mary action?
No, it has rye whiskey, apricot marmalade, peach bitters, lemon sour.
There we go.
It's good.
Oh, I haven't tried that. Yeah. That sounds good.
Yeah.
Jill, let's go after the show. Well, we'll go check it out.
Exactly.
And share with us, we see Chef Ramsay and there are all these television shows and, you know, maybe in your day, who was, you know, how would you describe a chef from hell? What is a chef from hell?
Well, a chef from hell is not the guy who screams the loudest and is the most intimidating guy. Is actually the guy who doesn't taste his food or doesn't know what he's talking about. That's the chef from hell. You know, you can all deal with the screamers and the yellers and the guy who intimidates you and,
like being completely obnoxious, but if you don't taste the food and, you know, the proof is not in the pudding, then that's the chef from hell, you know.
And how about the customer from hell?
Well, there's not such a thing as a customer from hell.
Oh, sure there is.
Every customer is a great customer, you know, but it can get difficult if people try to change the menu around. And we had a few people who make us run, like, all over the place to make sure they get the food exactly the way they want it.
And, you know, I always had a question, and this could be way off topic, and I apologize if it is, but sometimes I read about spear-caught, line-caught fish. And I'm wondering what the difference is in terms of the taste for the consumer.
Well, you know, so let's assume you're a fisherman, right, and you fish tuna, right? So you always want to make sure you line caught the fish, right, and the fish comes out as quick as possible out of the water. The reason why is the fish fights less, the blood pressure gets less hard, and the meat gets much cleaner. So the faster the fish is out of the water, the less the fish fights, the better it is. And that's basically the bottom line.
Good to know. Thank
you. It is good to know.
I thought that was a marketing ploy as well.
I understand that there might be a little something in the work, perhaps. Maybe another property, maybe another project, since things are going well.
Yeah, things going very well. So we are blessed. We're actually looking at the property right now, and we searched a little bit for the last couple of years, couldn't find the right one, but we are getting very close right now, and it's very exciting. It's right here, so I cannot talk about it, obviously, but I think we might have something cooking up pretty soon again.
Excellent, excellent. And for those of you who haven't seen, I mean, my goodness, you know, newspaper articles here. We've got Laguna Beach, you know, new chefs on the block. Not sure if the camera can see this. And
is that a Firebrand Media publication?
That is. That is.
We don't talk about them.
We've got the 2014 Restaurant Awards, top 10 new restaurants. Right here, baby. Number one, Driftwood Kitchen. An event that I attended at the restaurant, which just came out in Laguna Beach magazine. You can see this. I know that our listeners can't see this, but it probably was just dropped at your doorstep. This was the Sip and Shuck. I have to be careful when I say this. I did a blog post called Shuck Me. That is with an S. Shuck Me. And tell us about this. You raised a lot of money for the Marine Mammal Center.
Exactly. So we do this event. We started it last year, and then obviously this year was our second event. We raised $10,000, and all the proceeds in the charity went to the Mammal Center for, you know, to save the sea lions. And we just released one a couple of days ago. So
over $10,000.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting.
Good job.
We got some tears in our eyes, you know, so it was great.
And you've brought some delicious goodies to share with us here this morning, and we can't wait to dive in. So tell us about that.
Simple hamachi tartar with fresh cilantro, and then some avocados in there, a little bit pine nuts, and then some radishes, and then we just marinated it with some with a little bit curry, obviously, some fine salts and peppers and stuff. Just keep it very simple, and that's going to go also on the new menu.
Sounds wonderful.
Yes.
Sounds wonderful. I didn't have breakfast this morning. Yeah, let's pass it around and give it a taste.
Of course.
You know, Valentine's Day is coming up, and what a great place to visit for Valentine's Day and take your loved one and be down there with the waves crashing and a gorgeous sunset at Driftwood The Deck.
So everybody take a taste. Gentlemen?
How do we...
There's some spoons out there.
Like
I forgot the spoons.
It's a shot.
It like a yes.
No, you can't do a
Jim,
shot.
Chug it. Yeah, no. Chug it.
You can't chug it.
It's not chuggable.
Yeah, chug it.
It's not chuggable.
Well, thank you. That is yummy.
Thank you. This looks delicious.
Of course.
All right. Thank you very much. It was great having you in here, by
thank
the way.
You.
We
thank
appreciate you,
so much.
You taking thank time you. Out of your busy day. Golf clap. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, just a reminder, you're listening to KX93.5, Laguna's Only FM. This is OC Caravan. I'm Scott Hayes. And coming up, we've got the legendary, the famous rock and roll photographer, Henry Diltz, who's here to talk about all the album covers he's shot over the years. Fascinating story, this guy. He's got some great stories about taking peyote out in the desert with the Eagles. I can't wait to hear that story in particular. April, want you to take us out with the Woodstock by CSNY from... their album, thank you.
God, he was walking along the road, and
All right, you're listening to KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. I'm Scott Hayes. This is OC Caravan. I'm in the room this morning, of course, with my co-host, Mr. Jim Bastian.
That was really good. We tasted that dish.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd had it for breakfast, but right. It was outstanding.
No, I heard what you would have for breakfast.
No, they're doing a great job over there. It's a great restaurant, great spot.
Yeah, that was a good segment. So thank you, Miss Sandy, for that. That was Woodstock, by the way, from the CSNY album, Grab Yourself Nash and Young. Of course, great song. I'm having a moment here, but I think it was written by Joni Mitchell.
It was.
Yeah. So that voice, by the way, and I'm so delighted to have this guest in our studio. I tried to reach out to Henry for months, and I never got a response back, And several weeks ago, by accident, we were at Zinc downtown.
Right.
And I'm standing right next to him, and I'm going, here's my moment. And he was very receptive. So in the studio this morning, we have the legendary rock and roll photographer, Henry Diltz, who has shot every imaginable rock icon that you can, you know, and more than 100 album covers. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, a couple hundred.
Couple hundred, wow. I'm going to give you just a nutshell, sort of a thumbnail sketch of Henry's background. He was the official photographer at Woodstock and the Monterey Music Festival.
Yep. Monterey Pop Festival.
He shot the album covers for the first Crosby, Stills, Nash album. Stephen Stills, that one with the blue sweater in the snow.
Right.
That was yours. I love that shot. Jim Morrison in the Doors. James Taylor, Sweet Baby James cover album. Jackson Browne's first album. not titled Saturate Before Using, but certainly it's on the title. Fogelberg, Souvenirs, The Eagles, both the first album and the Desperado. He's also had intimate photography sessions with the likes of Neil Young, Mick Jagger, Paul McCartney, Frank Zappa, Janis Joplin, Tom Waits, Eric Clapton, America, Springsteen, Michael Jackson, Garth Brooks, The Police, Ray Charles, The Who, Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain. How am I doing?
Yeah, I guess.
It's pretty impressive. Yeah. And I'm not done, Henry.
Okay.
He's also, his photographs were featured last year at the Grammy Museum in Los Angeles, and he's the co-founder of the Morrison Hotel, which specializes in fine art rock and roll photography.
Right, Morrison Hotel Gallery.
Yeah. Gallery, excuse me. So,
yeah.
Henry, I guess I'm so delighted to have you here. There's so much I want to get to. My first question is, I'm going to go way back to when you were the, quote, official photographer of Woodstock. Mm-hmm. I want to know how you became the official photographer for Woodstock and what it was like to have sort of the best seat in the house.
Yeah, well, you know, this whole trip has been sort of an accident.
Yeah? Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, before I was a photographer, I was a folk singer, folk musician. And I played in a group called the Modern Folk Quartet. And in the early 60s, we spent about 5 years doing college concerts and folk clubs and TV shows back and forth across the country.
Yeah.
And,
you know, let me play a little soundtrack, April. Let's play a little bit of this. This is called...
Reach out, tell somebody.
Is that you?
Yes, that's the Modern Folk Quartet. Years later, I mean, this is, I guess Mozart is a kind of folk music.
I guess.
But, you know, we did quite a few albums of folk music. And then we went to Japan in the late 80s, early 90s, and they at one point asked us if we would do a Mozart album. So this is an a cappella Mozart song.
Yeah.
But,
so we're talking about how you got to be at Woodstock.
Yeah. Well, during those folk days, there was a lighting director named Chip Monk. His name was Edward Berenson
Chip
Monk. And his nickname was Chip.
Yeah.
So everyone called him Chip Monk. And he was a lighting guy on I think we were in Daytona Beach, Florida, doing a big festival of some kind. And we got to know him real well. And so years later, he was working with Michael Lang on Woodstock. And he called me one day. I was in my kitchen up in Laurel Canyon, and the phone rings. Chip says, "Henry, we're having a great big festival music concert out here in New York. You ought to be out here for it." And I said, "Well, Chip, I'd love to, but I don't know those people. How am I going to do that?"
Yeah.
You know. He said, "Well, I'll talk to the producer." And the next day, Michael Lang called. He said, "Chip says we need you out here, so I'm sending you a ticket and $500."
Wow. Wow. So you were there for the full full concert?
Yeah, I was there for 2 weeks before the concert, photographing the stage construction and the whole, you know, building of the whole property and the camping grounds and the hog farm, you know, tent city and all of that stuff. Just kind of documenting.
You were there shooting pictures of, say, Richie Havens.
Oh, yeah.
Santana, The Who, Crosby, Stills, Nash.
Yeah.
Jimi Hendrix.
Yes.
All of those artists who were at that event.
All of those people. And some of them I knew. I mean, in the folk days, we had been on the road with Richie Havens doing a folk tour. And then Crosby, Stills, Nash, this was right after they had recorded their first album, which I did the album cover for.
Which we're going to talk about.
So they were friends of mine. So I did have, you know, friends around there. And,
I've never spoken to anybody who's been to Woodstock. So
is that right?
That's right. And I want to know what that experience was like.
About 400,000 or 500,000 people.
I know. What was that experience like? Yeah. And can you give me one sort of moment that best stands out for you?
Well, you know, the first 2 weeks, it was like at summer camp. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there were all these hippie carpenters with their shirts off sawing and hammering and building this great big wooden deck in the middle of a green alfalfa field. So it was like an aircraft carrier, and the alfalfa was the sea, you know, waving in the wind. And, you know, sunny days, and the hippie girls would bring lunch for everybody and from the office. And, yeah, it was just great. And then one day there was a little group of people sitting up on the hillside, and I remember my first thought was, "Well, what the heck are they doing up there? Oh, yeah, wait a minute. This is going to be a music concert, you know." Uh-huh. You kind of lost track of that because that wasn't happening at all.
Yeah.
And then the next day there were a few thousand, and the next day 400,000.
Right.
And then I was trapped there. I couldn't get a mile down the road to my boarding house. I had a rented station wagon parked behind the stage, which I then lived in for 3 days and slept in because you couldn't get down the road. There were so many cars and so many people. You couldn't drive down the road.
What was the rain like? And was there preparation for it?
Rain came that one, I think, Saturday afternoon. Right. And in fact, at every Woodstock, it rains one day, you know. Because
right.
I also shot Woodstock 94 and Woodstock 99.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then you have the mud people, you know, the people that slide in the mud and get covered with mud. And that's all a part of it.
Back to the original Woodstock, of all the artists you shot that weekend, is there one in particular that sort of moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, the one moment, of course, that stands out is Monday morning when Jimi Hendrix went on.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he was supposed to close the show Sunday night, but it was so backed up that he didn't go on until just dawn on Monday morning. And, boy, these guys walked out on stage with these colorful bandanas. And, you know, we had been up virtually for 3 days. I mean, I'd get a couple hours sleep, but so we were a little dingy, a little shell-shocked, and these guys came out, whoa, and they started playing. And when he played the Star Spangled Banner, that was the moment.
Yeah.
Because that song echoing out and bouncing off the hillside and coming back, just his solo guitar playing the Star Spangled Banner, complete with all the sound effects, you know, the meow, bop, 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 the, you know, bombs and machine guns and planes diving. It was startling. It was mesmerizing, hypnotizing. And there was a feeling. Because, you know, we were all anti-Vietnam War and anti-government and all of that stuff. You know, we wanted the new hippie paradigm, the new world, you know. And so there was a moment there where you thought, well, wait a minute. That's, was he playing that song? You know, that's their song. And then, no, wait a minute. That's our song, too, you know. And so it was a real patriotic moment,
Now, that's amazing. So you then lived in Laurel Canyon. Which was an amazing place back then, still is today.
What was
that experience like? And tell us about Laurel Canyon.
Yeah, Laurel Canyon is kind of a mythical place now. It's kind of like Camelot. Mm-hmm. It's really just, 5 minutes up from Sunset Strip, up in the hills that divide the valley from Hollywood. And I guess in the 30s and 40s, movie stars would rent or buy or build little cabins up there. So there were all these little houses, each one of them different, you know, and so in the 60s, musicians would rent these places because they could afford it. And
studios were close.
Hmm?
The studios were close, and all the
clubs everything was close. Just 5 minutes down the hill.
Yep.
And in fact, one handy thing was if your car wouldn't start in the morning, you could just coast downhill. And it was a gas station at the bottom. I did that a few times. But you know, it was 5 minutes away from Hollywood, and you were out in the country with coyotes and owls and, you know, just really out in the country.
Were you living there during the period of time that Fogelberg was recording his first album?
Yes.
Yeah. And I always heard stories, I don't know if these are true or not, but that he was playing one of his songs off that first album. Maybe it was To the Morning or one of those. And it just sort of echoed throughout the canyon there. And people weren't really sure who he was or what he was working on at the time.
No, what happened was He rented a little house right across the street from me. There was a little cabin that changed hands quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife, Elizabeth, and I would come back from going out to dinner, and we'd hear this beautiful piano music coming from that house. We didn't know who was living there. Mm-hmm. And so we'd walk halfway up the brick steps and sit there and listen. It sounded a little bit like Joni Mitchell. I mean, it was just very beautiful, melodic piano. No singing, just music. And this happened a few days in a row. And then I went out on the road. And the next morning, my wife was watering the flowers at the front of the house, and this guy walks across the street and says, he says, "Hi, I'm Dan Fogelberg." She says, "I'm Elizabeth Diltz." He said, "Diltz, are you any relation to Henry Diltz?" I said, "Yes, I'm his wife." He said, "Oh," he said, "I've came to town to do my album, and I've been looking for Henry Diltz to do my album cover."
And you did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we were great friends from then on. Yeah.
This past weekend, I watched the documentary Under the Covers, A Magical Journey, Rock and Roll in LA in the 60s and the 70s.
Right.
I want to kind of talk briefly about some of the album covers you shot.
Uh-huh.
One of the first ones I wanted to talk about was the very first Crosby, Stills, Nash album cover, the three of them sitting on the couch in front of that, I don't know what it was, a building of some sort.
Yeah, a little.
That was yours?
Yeah.
What was that experience like working with that particular group album?
Yeah, I knew those guys individually and collectively. I mean, I knew Stephen Stills in, I think, 63 or 4 when our folk group played New York City. And he was playing in a little club, and he would come down to hear us and his breaks, and we'd go see him in our breaks. And I knew Graham from the Hollies, and I knew David Crosby before the Byrds, and all through the Byrds. And so these three guys had this super group. And so they were all very good friends of mine. And at that point, I was working with a graphic artist named Gary Burden, who grew up in Laguna Beach, as a matter of fact. And so they were doing this album. They had no publicity photos. So we went out one afternoon just to take some photos because they had no pictures, you know, and they were halfway through with the album. And we went around West Hollywood, stopping here and there, jumping out of the car, taking photos. And Graham had seen this old funky house right off of Santa Monica Boulevard. And so we went by there, and they jumped on that couch, and we took pictures. We weren't, it wasn't planned to be an album cover. We were just taking pictures.
How does one decide out of all the pictures you shot maybe that day to pick that one?
Well, for album covers, it was my partner, Gary Burden, who was, we became a team. He was the graphic artist. So I would take, you know, 500, 1,000 pictures. He would look through them all and pick the one.
Wow.
And then he would lay it out, and he was so perfect, unerring, you know, in picking the right one. But, you know, that particular picture, we took the picture, and on the couch, they are from left to right, Nash, Stills, and Crosby.
Right.
And they hadn't named themselves yet. So during the time we developed the film, had a slideshow, and said, boy, that's a nice shot. We could use that for an album cover. But look, in the last couple of days, we've decided to call ourselves Crosby, Stills, Nash, so we're backwards. And so there was some thought of flipping the picture over, but then Stephen would be holding the guitar backwards. Yeah. So that would never work. So I said, let's just go back. It'll take 5 minutes. We'll jump on the couch, click, 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 we're done. So we got in the car and drove back, and the house was gone.
So that's funny.
One of my favorite bands of all time is The Doors, and one of my favorite albums is Morrison Hotel. So you did the album cover for that.
Well, The Doors called Gary and I, said, we've got this new album. We want you to do the cover. So we went and met them at their office, and we said, okay, do you have a title? They said, no, we don't have a title yet. And, well, do you have some kind of an idea what you want, you know, on the cover? And, no, we don't have, you know, that's why we called you guys, you know, and we're scratching our heads going, well, okay, let's see. And then Ray Manzarek just randomly spoke up. He said, you know, the other day my wife Dorothy and I were driving through downtown L.A. and we saw this old funky hotel. It's at Morrison Hotel. And we just said, wow, you know, that sounds, you know.
Right.
We probably said groovy. You know? And so we went right down and saw the hotel and went back a week later to take the picture. And the story goes, the guy behind the desk wouldn't let us photograph in the lobby. It was a transient hotel. Rooms, $2.50, you know. And like winos would sleep it off in there. And so this guy wasn't going to let us shoot. So I said, okay, come on outside, you guys. And I thought, well, I'll have them stand in front of that window. They can't stop us because we're on the sidewalk. And as we walked outside and they were about to stand there, I saw a light go on in the lobby. And I looked through the window, and it was the elevator light. And I looked at the desk. The guy had gotten in the elevator.
Uh-oh.
So I said, run in there. They ran in, got behind the window. We took one roll of film and got out of there. That was the album cover.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
The other one I want to talk about, and then we're going to move on to a lot more stuff. And I know I feel like I'm rushing, but we're sort of down to only 30 minutes. I wish we had, you know, a lot more time. You shot two Eagles album covers. You shot the very first album cover.
In the desert.
And then In the Desert, and then Desperado. And I want to go back to the first one, In the Desert.
Right.
Because I had heard stories you guys took peyote out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know what it's like. I don't know anybody who's taken peyote with the Eagles and shot their photo. I want to know what that experience was like for you.
Yeah.
Well, I want to know what it was like while you were on peyote.
Well, you know, we were hippies and, you know, we used substances to, you know, to enlighten ourselves, you know, and make things a little more interesting. Of course, people were smoking God's herb, you know.
Sure.
And mushrooms weren't really around so much. Peyote buttons are kind of like mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
So we were experimenting with psychedelics. And Gary and I had hit on an idea when we would do an album cover for a group, we'd try to get them out of town on an adventure somewhere, because then we would have all day or all night, and they wouldn't be, you know, they wouldn't have their girlfriends or their managers or their, and of course there were no cell phones then.
Right.
So we'd get them out of town. We'd go to Big Sur, we'd go, you know, some Indian reservation or the desert or whatever it was. And so for this, we, you know, the Eagles loved the desert and the whole mystique of the desert. And
right.
And we knew a Chumash Indian medicine man named Samu, And so we learned all about peyote buttons and whatnot, and we had these. They're like little round chips of wood, and you've got to scrape the fuzz out of the center because that's strychnine. And you scrape that out, and then you pop them in your cheeks and just suck on them, and they really taste bitter. But then after about a half an hour, they taste pretty good. So we went out to the desert, and we left the Troubadour Club at 2 in the morning.
Wow.
And then we got there, 3-hour drive to Joshua Tree. We got there about 5 in the morning. It was still dark. And we climbed the mountain in the dark and got up to the top. And we spent the whole day on top of the mountain and into the next night. And we had a teapot bubbling on the fire with peyote buttons in it and made peyote tea. You know, really, we laughed a lot. Uh-huh. We laughed the whole time. We had a great time just laughing. And Gary, my partner Gary, would always say, just shoot everything.
Right.
Film's the cheapest part, you know. So I would. I mean, that was my nature anyway, just to document. I was kind of a rabid photographer at that point. You know?
And then the one shot that you settled on for the mm-hmm. album cover, mm-hmm. do you remember that moment?
Well, Gary was kind of an innovator. What he wanted to do with that particular cover, because if you remember it, it's really a blue sky with a little eagle up on the top and a cactus silhouette on the bottom. That cover actually was going to open up to be four covers square. So it would be the size of four album covers, and it would be a poster. And at the top was the sky, and then the bottom was the cactus silhouette, and then the guys were sitting around the campfire in the bottom of that. And then the inner sleeve, instead of being paper, was cardboard with a beautiful cactus flower on it. But David Geffen thought that would be confusing, so he told him, just glue it shut. But so when you opened that up, a double fold, you saw the eagles upside down sitting around a campfire. And so nobody ever got the real effect of that. You were
That's
supposed
too
to
bad.
Open that up and put it on the wall.
That's
David Geffen.
There you go.
You know, he saved, you know, a penny or two an album, which amounted to millions.
Sure.
You know?
Or billions. Yeah.
All right, listen, this is what we're going to do. We're going to take a short 1-minute musical break, and we're going to shift gears. We got a lot more to talk about. In the studio, KX93.5 is Henry Diltz, famed, legendary rock and roll photographer. We're going to go out with one of your favorite songs by Don Henley, Glenn Frey, Desperado, but the Linda Ronstadt version of that song. April, take us out of here, please.
Desperado, why don't you come to senses. You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. These things that are pleasing you will hurt you somehow. Don't you try Queen of Diamonds, but she'll beat you if she's able. The Queen of Hearts is always your best bet. Well, it seems to me some fine things have been laid upon your table, but you only want the
You're listening to KX93.5 Laguna's Only FM. This is OC Caravan, Scott Hayes, Jim Bastian with legendary photographer Henry Diltz. Henry, we were talking about all your amazing photography with album covers. In this day and age where everything's downloaded, all music is bought online, there's no longer that vinyl album experience that kids used to have me growing up. What's your observation in terms of album art, album photography today compared to when you were doing all of your work?
Yeah, well, you know, that was an art form that's kind of disappeared in a way, although groups now are putting out vinyl 12-inch
albums.
Right,
it seems to have a resurgence now.
Yeah, it is, and people are collecting that old, you know, album cover art, used album covers and stuff. It's a disappeared art form. It was so wonderful, you know, it was such a great palette to create on. I mean, it was a nice 12-inch square, you know, to fill.
Now you got to look at one of these and get it on your little screen.
Tiny stuff, you know.
It's still there. There's still obviously photography, but...
I mean, we're all so connected up nowadays, you know, that, I mean, you lose one thing, but you gain another. I mean, I think many more people get to hear the music, but you don't have those wonderful album covers anymore.
Right.
But it'll evolve. It'll change, you know.
Yeah. I think it's coming back. I think people are starting to realize that there's a little bit more to the music experience than simply downloading it and listening it on your phone.
So. Yeah.
By the way, if you have a question for Henry Diltz and you want to call in, you can call 949-715-5936. 949-715-5936. This is a really off-the-topic observation, but I was researching you for this show, and I saw a YouTube video of you in a bar singing the Daydream Believer with David Cassidy. How surreal is that?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Is that true?
Sure, yeah. I mean, in the early days, I photographed, you know, teeny bopper stuff, you know?
Yeah.
The Monkees. I was the Monkees photographer for a couple of years. And then the Partridge Family, you know, for Tiger Beat magazine and 16 magazine. Got to be really good friends with David Cassidy and traveled around the world with him in the 70s. But that song, Daydream Believer, was written by my dear friend John Stewart, who was a folk singer. And he wrote that song in 5 minutes, shaving in the mirror.
No kidding.
And so the Monkees at one point got a new producer who happened to be Chip Douglas, who sang in my group with me, the Modern Folk Quartet.
Oh, gotcha.
And he thought that that song would be perfect for Davy Jones, so he taught it to Davy, and it became, you know, one of their biggest hits.
Yeah.
And, yeah, lovely song. So I can't remember why I was singing in a bar with David Cassidy, but we happened to be there. You know?
Just the idea of it sort of struck me as interesting, you know. What a lifestyle you've led.
Yeah.
You know, with all your photography and all these people you've met over the years. I want to talk about, you've got a series of books out there. I mean, you're still doing photography, yes,
right.
But it's these books that you got, that you've had come out over the years. One is called Henry Diltz, Unpainted Faces.
Yeah.
Came out in 2011. Canyon of Dream, The Magic and the Music of Laurel Canyon.
Right.
Came out in 2012. From the Doors to Corbain. Four Decades of Music Captured by the Legendary Photographer. And California Dreamin', which is the one you've got in front of you, right?
Right.
Is that that? Can you hold that up and let the camera see?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And what's this album all about?
This book, California Dreaming, is published by an English publishing company called Genesis Publications. And they do limited edition coffee table books. There's only 2,000 of them made, and they're numbered and signed. And they do such a great job. I mean, I could never have a finer book than that. It's a $500 coffee table book.
It's beautiful.
You have to order it from England, from Genesis Publications.
I mean, this is probably a 500, 700-page book. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. Several hundred pages. But,
beautiful coat of cloth covering. Talk about the binding.
It's got Levi cover. And then the box that it comes in is a tie-dyed box, and that's John Sebastian's tie-dyes.
Really?
They actually scanned his jacket and made that tie-dye box to put it in.
Yeah. That's amazing.
That's really cool.
Do you have a new book? Do you have a new book coming out?
Well, this one is about 5 or 6 years old. There's still a couple hundred left. The newest one is that Unpainted Faces that you mentioned. Unpainted Faces is translated from a Japanese word that means kind of natural. There's a word in Japanese that means natural, kind of, you know, and another translation would be unpainted faces. So it's a black and white book of just, you know, music photos, documentary style. And so that came out. And then I'm going to do Later this year, I'm going to put out Painted Faces, which is going to be the companion one, which will be color. So we'll have the black and white and the color book together.
So Kurt Cobain, yeah, what was that like? And
yeah, well, you know, Kurt Cobain is a lot of the people I photographed were dear friends of mine that I knew for years, hung out with, you know, and smoked it with, and you know, drank beers with, and lived in Laurel Canyon with, and went on the road with. I mean, lots of Crosby, Stills, Nash, the Eagles, and Jackson Brown, Joni Mitchell. Those were all really good friends. Kurt Cobain, being from Seattle, I didn't really know him. And so he was playing in L.A., and my young teenage daughter, Zoe, she was 13, she wanted to see Nirvana. And I said, well, I you know, I don't know those guys, but I know their management company. So I called them up, and they gave me a couple of tickets, and they put a photo pass in there. So I brought my cameras, and my daughter and I were sitting kind of way in the back because we got our tickets really late. And I had binoculars, and I could see all my friends in the front of the stage photographing. And so Zoe's mom, my wife Elizabeth, had said, now don't you let her out of your sight for a minute, you know. And so I'm thinking, I'm an idiot. I should be down there shooting, you know. And I said, Zoe, honey, just sit here. Don't move, you know. And I went down there, and I got to shoot one song.
Oh.
And I got down there. I had to work my way all the way down to the front of the I think it was the Forum. And so by the time I got there was only one song left that I could shoot. We could only shoot three songs. And he was kind of standing there, not really moving, and the light was kind of yellow. It was kind of a boring shot. I took a few shots, and I thought, well, this was a waste of time. And then at the very end of the song, he turned around and kind of threw his head back, and the lights were perfect, and it was just this magic shot. One shot on the roll. And I always thought that was sort of a gift from God, you know.
What would you say? Wow. What would you say is one of the more iconic photos you've ever shot?
Well, one of my favorites is Sweet Baby James.
Okay, why?
That picture. Well, first of all, I mean, I love James Taylor's music and his playing, you know, as a folk singer myself. And I love that song. However, when I took the picture, I had never heard the song because, you know, the album comes out after you take the picture. But we went to my friend's house. So it was called The Farm, and they had these little sheds and barns, and I knew that would be a good place to photograph them. And all they wanted was publicity photos, which meant black and white because newspapers couldn't print color. So I was shooting black and white, and he leaned on this great big pole. You know, he's a big, tall guy, and it was about a six-foot pole, and he leaned on the top of it. I took a few black and whites, and I said, wait a minute, James, don't move. And I reached down and got my color camera. I was thinking, I need to get a color shot to show in slideshows to my friends, because that's what I like to do, was to have slideshows. And you can't project a black and white in those days.
Yeah.
So I said, wait a minute, just let me take a color shot just for myself. And then the manager saw the color shot, and then they used it for the album cover. So it was a lot of these album covers are not, they're, none of them are really sort of planned and set up,
yeah.
You know. They all are kind of accidental.
Wow.
Yeah. Hey, so I want to talk a little bit about the Morrison Hotel Gallery. You have a Morrison Hotel Gallery in L.A.?
Yes,
we do. And you have one in
New York.
Mm-hmm. And can you just sort of brief people on the concept behind it and why they might be interested in visiting?
Yeah. You know, after 40, 45 years of shooting photos, people used to say, oh, you must have quite an archive. And I hated that word. It sounded too professional. You know, all my life, people say, oh, you're a photographer. Are you a professional? And I would say, no, you know, I just love to do it.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I did have what they call an archive. I mean, a big, you know, cardboard boxes full of negatives and pictures. And we kind of organized it all with a couple partners. We started touring it across the country. And we'd go to a different city once a month on a weekend and have a show and sell prints. And finally, we ended up in New York, and we got a little place in Soho, a little storefront that was up for lease. And we had a weekend show, and it went really well. And we said, well, we're going to take all these down now, but this place is empty. It's up for lease. So we made a deal with the landlord that, you know, we'll give you X amount of, you know, cash once a week, and as soon as you lease it, we'll leave. And so we did that, and we were 1 year in one place, and then we moved to another and another. And finally, we found a permanent place right in Soho on Prince Street. That was about 12 years ago, 13 years ago. And we had no name for this gallery. It just said the photography of Henry Diltz. And one day we had the Doors picture in the window that said Morrison Hotel on it. And I was across the street with my partner. And I said, now, I said, Peter, look at that window. We have nothing on our window. And look at that picture in the window, how nice that looks on the window in the photograph. Why don't we put that on our window? You know, just sort of attention-getting thing. Yeah. And he said, that's a good idea. I'll call a painter tomorrow. And so we got accidentally called the Morrison Hotel Gallery. But it says rock and roll without saying, you know, right. Rock and roll.
So it's a gallery where people can come in and visit and look at all these great photographs you've shot over the years.
Yeah, well, in the beginning, 13 years ago, it was all my photos.
Okay.
And you just walk in, and every photo, 100 photos were all mine. And, yeah, they were for sale in different sizes, different prices, framed, unframed, whatever.
And prints, originals, that sort of thing? I mean, how's that
they
work?
They were original. Yeah, okay. Printed from the negative or the slide. Okay. Right. And then my partner said, you know, after a year or so, a couple of years, he said, we should have someone else in here with you. Who would you, of all the music photographers, who would you like to have in here with you? And I said, Jim Marshall. Jim Marshall was a San Francisco guy. He was kind of my guru, you know, of music photography. So he joined us. We had a big show, and that was great. Then we got Neil Preston from L.A., who'd been on the road with Led Zeppelin. Then we got Bob Gruen from New York, who had shot John Lennon and Yoko. And one by one, we added photographers. Now we represent 120 photographers.
Amazing.
So if you walk into our gallery, you'll see photos from everyone. I'm lucky if I have two or three on the wall. But we have a website, morrisonhotelgallery.com. And even in the gallery, people look on the website and they can order.
Beautiful.
So you order and then we ship the picture to you. So then we opened one in L.A. a few years ago. Right now we're at the Sunset Marquee Hotel in L.A. and the W Hotel in L.A. And, you know, we almost opened one up here in Laguna.
Oh.
There was a great place right on Coast Highway, but we didn't move quick enough, and then it was gone, and we never did. But one day I wouldn't mind having one in Laguna.
Oh, that'd be a beautiful idea. Jim?
So is there anybody that you regret not taking a picture of at some point? Is there the one shot you didn't get, the one person that you wanted that you didn't get?
I think probably John Lennon, because I never really did shoot the Beatles, although I did go to Shea Stadium with the Lovin' Spoonful. And we ended up in their dressing room just before the show with the Lovin' Spoonful and the Beatles and I.
Oh, wow.
But I never really had any Beatle pictures. But after the Beatles, I did a lot of McCartney, a lot of Ringo, and a little bit of George at Bangladesh. George. But John Lennon is one guy that I never got to photograph.
Who did you most enjoy spending time with of all the musicians and artists that you've photographed over the years? Is there anyone in particular that you really enjoyed his or her company? I know there are a lot. Don't get
there
me wrong. And I don't want you to pick one,
you
but
know,
anybody
you
that
know.
Sort of surfaces in your brain right now?
I mean, Crosby, Stills, Nash were really good friends, so it's always fun to hang out with them. Mm-hmm. Paul McCartney, he's a Beatle, you know.
Right.
And he's just such a great guy. I loved hanging out with him. The Eagles were particularly fun on the road. They knew how to tour really well and how to do all of that, you know. In later years, I photographed Garth Brooks a lot. I still do.
Yeah,
he's a wonderful guy to work for. Such a great guy. I always say the three gentlemen of the music industry that I think are really true human beings who look you right in the eye and they're just really great people are Paul McCartney, Graham Nash, and Garth Brooks.
Wow, that's very interesting.
All three of those guys, as famous as they are, they haven't lost their their one-on-one sort of, you know.
How about the Police? What was it like to work with them?
You know, I've shot Sting before. Okay. I think I did one Police concert. They weren't a group that I hung out with a lot. You know, just took a few photos of them.
So for you, the personal relationships are really what sort of made the job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the personal relationships is why I even became a photographer. I mean, I didn't set out to be one.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, I was a musician. And I, on the road, we picked up these secondhand cameras on a tour, and one of the guys in the group bought film, said, here's your film. I put it in, and when we got the film developed, it was slide film. So I said, well, let's have a slideshow. And when we got all our friends together to look at these slides, it was such a great thing that I said, I got to do more of this stuff so we can have more slideshows. And that was my whole,
So with photography today and digital, have you changed with it or do you still shoot on film?
I shoot digital now. I thought I never would. I said, I'm a film guy. I'll never shoot digital. But it's just so easy to do. it's virtually the same. I mean, I miss having a negative.
Right.
I mean, and really, you know, now that years have passed, it's all those 60s and 70s photos people want. So I'm still dealing with the slides and the film, and, you know, we print from negatives. I mean, I shoot digital now,
right?
But all of the famous pictures were really done, you know, some time ago.
Speaking of digital, I've got a little $90 Samsung camera that I bought about 4 weeks ago. I've only taken one picture on it.
Oh, my God.
I'm wondering if you could just push a button for me so I can say I have an original Henry Dilt of myself.
A little pocket camera, too, a little Canon. I use this more than a big camera.
As you're taking a picture, by the way, what are you looking for in the camera's eye that sort of tells you you've got the moment?
Well, one thing is framing.
Uh-huh.
You need to, let's see.
You want to pose? You don't want posing, right?
1, 2, 3. I don't know how to, like, set the lighting on this very well, but there it is.
All right, thank you.
Oh, that's good, yeah. For me, it's framing.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
When they were film cameras, you had to know the technical part, how to set the f-stop and the time, or have a light meter to take a reading. That was just a mechanical thing. But you get to pick the moment you push the button. So you're looking through there, you're looking at the person you're photographing, and you wait until they look the way you want them to look, and then you push the button, and then you got it. You know?
Yeah.
But I think framing, which is kind of an unconscious thing for me, is, you know, move in, fill the frame. You know, in kindergarten, they teach the kids, you know, fill the whole paper with your drawing, with the crayons, you know, draw right out to the edge. And it's the same with photographs. You want to, you have that little square, and you want to compose something that feels good in that square, you know.
We've got about 2 minutes. Why is photography a great art form?
Well, you know, you've got your five senses, right? And I think, you know, seeing and hearing are two of the biggest ones, right? So, you know, music and photos, I mean.
Yeah.
Or, you know, movies, you know, that's a big part of life, too. I mean, I think those are two of our major senses, seeing and hearing. And so that encompasses, you know, photography and music.
Anybody today that you haven't shot that you would love to take a picture of? Anybody that just sort of stands out and go, gosh, I wish I had my moment with this person?
You know, I don't really have those kind of thoughts or feelings. I just photograph 100 pictures a day, wherever I am, whatever I see, just stuff on the street or, you know.
So you still bring your camera everywhere you go and you still
shoot
a
picture? This little pocket Canon.
Yeah.
You know, I was telling someone earlier, instead of 40 pounds of cameras, I would have two cameras, black and white and color. Then I would have five lenses, a spot meter, flash, batteries, film. Now I traded all that in on this little tiny pocket camera, big as a cigarette pack.
Yeah.
And it also shoots video, sound video. You know, in the 60s, I used to shoot a lot of Super 8. Shot Super 8 film, 3 minutes for a cassette and no sound.
Yeah,
I can do an hour's movie on this, and it'll have sound and color and everything. So,
you've led an extraordinary life as a photographer. I mean, sort of a photographer's dream life when you look at it. In a lot of ways, you've been blessed with your career and these great album covers and these great artists that you've shot over the years. To those photographers who are just starting up and they want to achieve sort of the same success that Henry Dilts has achieved, what advice might you give them?
You know, I always tell people, photograph your friends. I mean, that's all I know. That's what I did. I photographed my friends, you know, and so I could show pictures to them in slideshows, and that taught me how to deal with people. And, you know, that or if you want to be a music photographer, meet groups. Offer to take free photos. You know, let me come to your – and don't only do concerts. Try to get them – go to their sound check, go to their rehearsal, go to their – you know, get them when they're, you know, together in the afternoon, and then you'll have photos that other people won't have.
You said try to deal with people. I mean, I got to believe as a photographer, a big part of your job is getting people involved in the process of shooting those photos. Mm-hmm. Was there any one particular, and we got 30 seconds, anyone in particular who's the most difficult for you?
My automatic answer is always David Crosby. Because
why?
Because he's kind of, you know, likes to be bratty. Uh-huh. You know, he'd give you the finger or something. You
How
know,
funny. We'll have to cut the finger out, by the way.
He's a good friend, though, you know, but he likes to give you a hard time, so
beautiful.
I always say that.
Where can people go to learn more about you, my friend?
Go to morrisonhotelgallery.com, or you can go to my Facebook page, Henry Dilts Photography. It's Facebook.com, and then Henry Dilts Photography. And I post a couple of pictures a week up on that.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming
in.
Great, great conversation today.
Pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. I'm Scott Hayes here with my co-host Jim Bastian, and this, of course, is OC Caravan. As a reminder, 8 p.m. tonight, 12 noon tomorrow, our show airs on Cox, and tonight is John Vallely.
Yep.
Yeah, any last words, Jim, before we head out?
Nope. It was a great show, as always.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you again, Henry.
Thank you.
April, take us out with a little music, please.
Cowboy, he lives on the range. His horse and his cattle are his only companions. He works in the saddle and he sleeps in the canyons, waiting for summer, his pastures to change.